Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Severin, this is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers, and my name is Severin. I'm coming to you today from the barn plug at Blue House Farm in Pescadero, California, where there is good reception, and I'm joined by Jamie from, wow, where are you in the world?
Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Cool. Well, welcome to the show. Will you mind giving us a little introduction on how you are in Albuquerque and the projects that you run elsewhere?
Sure. Rio Grande Community Farm is a 501c3 nonprofit. We manage 150 acres of public land, which is managed by the City of Albuquerque's Open Space Division. And we are a certified organic farm that does a number of programs, including a community garden. We grow wildlife, habitat, and feed, as well as have a number of education programs and big community events like our annual maize maze.
I'm very excited about this annual party. Tell us a little bit how the project got started and then how you and why you came to be a part of it yourself.
Well, the farm has been around for quite some time now. When the city bought the land that we farm on in 1997, so long before either of us were here, they wanted to keep the land preserved in its agricultural conditions all around us. There had been just around Albuquerque in general, there have been tons of, you know, sprawl developments, and the city bought the land, which has a history of some of the oldest continuous farming.
Archaeologists think that this piece of land has been continually farmed for about 2,000 years, which is one of the oldest pieces in North America. So that's a really unique gem that we have being here in New Mexico, which is a historical narrative longer than most of the country has.
And we do a whole bunch of stuff with, you know, our neighbors and school children and yada yada, community members in mind. So, where do we go from here?
And then how did you guys get involved? What drew you to the project? Sounds like the historical significance of the land and the quality of what has been going on there for so many years was a major attraction. What else drew you to want to be in the agriculture?
So I was going to graduate school here in the city right after being a Peace Corps volunteer in rural Latin America. So I was really missing rural lifestyle, and I was missing also environmental education, which I had been doing as a Peace Corps volunteer. And so the farm at the time had a great opportunity to volunteer for school groups leading field trips, and so that's how I first got started, and it developed into a position for me, which was really exciting, and I've been enjoying.
And for myself, I found the farm through AmeriCorps. They have had an AmeriCorps volunteer program for a number of years. And so I joined the farm that way and just got interested in doing, you know, a number of our community programs, namely the community garden, which is one of the big projects that I'm undertaking or continuing with now that I've finished my year of service as a farm intern.
Nice. So you both wiggled in through the cracks.
Yep.
just to talk a little more about the, you know, that history, like the crops that were being grown there historically, and your emphasis now on native plants and habitat plants, and it sounds like native, like you're doing some native nursery or native seed growing.
You know,
and how that relates to what's appropriate for the climate.
That's a great tie-in to, you know, a bigger issue that we are working with in New Mexico and in drought. We have actually seen the majority of the field and a lot of farmland, I mean, in the country, but here in New Mexico and on our property, is grown in cover crops, which typically aren't particularly native, and they're not necessarily drought adapted. I mean, there's about 100 acres that the other farmer on the property manages that he grows in alfalfa, and we do grow a variety of different mixes with some native oats and stuff like that, but you know, that's something that we're still developing. And there's a lot of initiatives that we're tangentially involved with, you know, seed swapping projects and that sort of thing. But we are still behind the ball on getting a lot of the drought-adapted stuff going. Although our biggest success in that realm has been building up a seed bank of a drought-adapted corn stock, which we have probably one of the bigger supplies of, just because we've been growing it for a number of years, and it's the Mexican June corn, which we actually used to plant our corn maize this year and plan to do in the future. And that's basically the corn maize is our biggest fundraiser, but it doubles as a feed supply for the migrating sandhill cranes, and is just a great example of the success of, you know, regionally adapted crops. So I think that's our biggest.
It's also a joke because it's a corn maze.
Yeah.
That was a bad joke.
Is corn maze.
So it's good that you're feeling, I mean, it's good that you're, I'm thankful that you're being so open about how challenging is the drought and how ill-prepared we all are to really be facing it, but that the work, that there is work ahead, and that there is really interesting work in discovering drought-resistant varieties and seeing contextually about what you can grow here or what grows in places that now have climates like what we're starting to have, et cetera, et cetera. What do kids say when they come to your spot? Like, what's their reaction? And do you feel like the little generation of young ones who are coming now are more kind of climate literate than say our generation was?
You know, the kids are really excited to see how food is grown, and bar none, I will ask them what do we struggle with in New Mexico, and they know that we're having issues with water, and there are a lot of really great educational resources here in New Mexico that teachers bring out to their classrooms, and great curriculum surrounding water and climate change awareness. And I, to speak as a whole, you know, I know that that I'm interacting with environmental educators, so I'm not sure on a whole how to compare this generation to the next, but I'm hopeful and optimistic about that.
Well, and that they're being exposed to agriculture and people who are happy in agriculture and feeling like thrivey and positive about agriculture probably sets them up to make some conclusions about where they might put their own life energy, which of course is my own not so secret mission in the world, is more farmers. But back to the, like, matrix of land. So this whole farm is spread out over a bunch of city-owned property. How does the city interact with you guys, and how do they experience the benefits of agriculture in managing those properties?
Well, there are a number of different benefits that the city yields that we all share just from putting this land in a farm use and keeping it in agricultural use. The vistas that we have with the Sandia Mountains in the backdrop and the amount of wildlife, like I mentioned, the migrating sandhill cranes, but we see coyotes and all sorts of songbirds and kestrels and just all manner of bird and beast are such benefits and such resources that I don't that open space really values, because you know that's they cater to you know visitors who want to go bird watching or just want to get out and enjoy a nice walk. That's not, you know, an incredibly rigorous hike in the mountains or anything like that. It's a really good first encounter for a lot of folks, especially with, you know, the students that we bring out, even just for the corn maze. The first time that people come out to the fields, they just fall in love with the place, and it's just keeping the... keeping the green in the valley is a theme that we see here, and there's a lot of agricultural heritage throughout New Mexico, but particularly within the valley, north and south, both valleys of Albuquerque.
Part of our contract with the city is to have 25% of our land in production for migrating wildlife, so various crops that cranes and other birds eat during their migration. So anyone who's remotely interested in birding in Albuquerque, immediately when I say the name of our site, they know immediately. And I think it's a really beautiful and unique thing. Also, the city maintains trails on the land, so unlike farms and privately held land, people are always out there walking, jogging, baby strollers, dog leashes. So it's a really great thing to share with the community.
Well, and I think that's a really important point in general to make. If we were talking, say we had an audience of other cities that maybe don't have yet a policy about their land use for abandoned land or for municipally owned or transportation or transportation district lands, to know that there's really compatible uses in agriculture, recreation, wildlife, water catchment, or whatever, groundwater. I think that case needs to be made more broadly. I mean, just every, you know, not most cities I go to don't have that kind of program going on. So you guys are really lucky to live in a town that a city that does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is a blessing. I mean, there are numerous partnerships throughout Bernalillo County and even within the open space that do all of those things. Another property in the South Valley, Sanchez Farm, has some swales, and they do a lot of educational programs there as well with some local growers and educational groups. So it is a pretty good, we are blessed to have supportive, you know, city officials and administration and just partners that make our work, you know, a lot more feasible and well-received, so.
So, now I'm just going to, I don't really know the answer that you're going to give, but in Tucson, there's a very strong food bank connection with the farms that are being run, and the food bank also has a kind of an informal distribution system that they do at the farmers markets for kind of homegrown and super small scale agricultural producers. Do you guys have any relationship with the food bank or kind of charity sector in your world, in your work, or where does your food go?
Yeah, we do have a relationship with food banks. We usually, it ends up, I couldn't give you like a stable figure, especially with just the impact of the drought this year. And, I think in the past it's been around 5% is what Catherine was recalling. I think it fluctuates, but we definitely we go to farmers markets and give away the produce that doesn't sell to the food banks, and we, you know, donate B-grade quality produce on a weekly basis to the. There's a number of different food banks in Albuquerque, and the whole network of farmers around the, you know, Middle Rio Grande corridor are pretty involved with that, and so it's a pretty successful operation. Similar to, I guess, I don't know about Tucson.
Yeah, we'd love to be connected with someone from Tucson to hear more about that, and maybe potentials to expand our programs and relationships.
Yeah, they're very cool. I would really encourage you to go visit their farmers market and see the scene, because they have, you know, you can use your food stamps to buy fruit trees and native trees that are fruiting, and you could go there and you could buy from, you know, like 15 or more growers food that the food bank had bought and then redistribute. So I was very impressed with their model and just like absorbing and understanding the kind of needs of the community, and then stepping up and kind of facilitating, and then basically all the food that doesn't sell through their little market goes to the food bank. So they're kind of using their nonprofit status and charitable, like the neediness of their client base to fulfill needs for the broader community and for people who are maybe not in the charity category, but who, you know, couldn't really benefit from fresh vegetables. Anyway, we don't have to talk more about Tucson since you're in Albuquerque, but let's talk a little bit more, if you don't mind, about the drought and what you guys are, like, how it feels and what you think about it. And when you talk and you're hoeing the long rows, what are you guys saying to each other, and how do you, I don't know, what's the context for this for you?
You know, I think a lot of farmers have, a lot of farmers in the Southwest have been aware and sort of planning to some extent for what comes when the rains stop or when the temperatures get even higher than they already are. Here in Albuquerque, I think there have been a lot of small efforts that need to collectivize that haven't really caught up. I think the individual level actions have exceeded the progress that has happened on, you know, a statewide level or the citywide level, even just with like the Conservancy District for the Middle Rio Grande, and just with the challenges of updating and navigating water rights law. It's it's a challenge that is going to take everybody to come together to solve. And I think some people, you know, for instance, the Conservancy District and others just were caught off their feet just because, you know, we've always had it this way, and even with the awareness that there will come a day, or would come a day, when the deposits would run dry. the contingency plans just weren't made well enough in advance and planned for. So.
I think it's especially difficult. It's difficult for everyone to understand New Mexico water rights. They're particularly tricky and convoluted. Can I say that? For the greater public to understand and then take collective democratic action is really challenging. But I think the drought has brought to light to the general public how much we depend on water, and that everyone's food source depends on water. So to have locally grown and hopefully more socially just food sources, we need to think about our water usage.
And, yeah, it's not so simple as that we all have to get in the ditch and dig the ditch, and that makes us all aware of our collective or kind of the commons of water in the way that the old acequia system kind of ordered that conversation. I like how you frame that in terms of that, you know, distracted? How does a complicated, highly networked, highly distracted population come together democratically to assign or address or make decisions? I feel like that goes for a lot of different natural resources. So when is your next maze, or has it already happened? Or what's coming up for you right now in the season? What are you guys busy doing outside?
So our maze event is an October, a fall event, and actually this year we thought it wasn't going to be able to happen because of the drought. We thought that the corn wasn't going to be impressive enough to make a maze that would attract the same level of traffic that we've had in the past. But a few weeks before October, we realized that we did have enough corn and sorghum next to the corn to make a small maze, and it was really inspiring and really, I think, gave a lot of us hope that so many people came out because it's a tradition for them and their families to come out. Because we definitely did not advertise this year like years in the past. And so we added a few components, a few educational and like family-friendly events. And I think that in the future that's going to really add to what the maze has been in the past. So.
As far as big events go on our calendar, that's the biggest one for sure. And we are working on some stuff for seasonal activities, like a big seasonal event quarterly. But the next big day we'll be having at the farm is going to be, we typically do the Martin Luther King Day of Service, so we're going to be having a bunch of folks out then. So if anybody in Albuquerque is listening and wants to come out and treat it as a day on, as they say, we'll be doing a bunch of good projects. We're right now just trying to weatherize, I suppose you could say, you know, just plan for having the same drought-related water shortages in the future, next year and beyond. So we're making a bunch of infrastructure upgrades, like at our community garden and in our crop land. And so the next big thing that's happening is most likely going to be at the volunteer day on MLK Day. So, but stay tuned for more events as they are planned.
Cool. Well, I wanted to get one level more specific about how, like, what infrastructure upgrades are, and like, if any, what are your kind of crop changes that you're making, or are you, you know, leaving more residues, or trying to, you know, incorporate more by more organic material than you had been, or just a little bit of some specific clues on your tactics?
Sure. Well, you know, we actually have been a little antiquated and sort of in the same boat with a bunch of other irrigators in our area with using the ancient technology of flood irrigation. Primarily at our community garden, but also in some of our crop fields for the production farm. And so we are going to be implementing more. We have our primary production field has like 14 acres, and it's all irrigated by subsurface drip tape. But we're going to be putting that similar infrastructure with drip tape and probably some more swale type designs in throughout the community garden. I think within our crop plan, I haven't gotten the latest look at it, but we'll just be doing more cover crop that is less thirsty, you know. And we hopefully will be able to get some more drought adapted cash crops in there with you know, grains and that sort of thing. The biggest ones, which have the most impact on, you know, the most people, I think, for us is going to be making the community garden more water efficient with drip irrigation and some swales and that sort of thing, as well as getting some more drought-tolerant crops in the ground for cover cropping.
All right. So there you have it from Albuquerque. I really highly recommend to anybody who's thinking about drought stuff, and I'm sure you've already heard about it, but Gary Nabhan just published a book on growing crops in a hotter, drier climate, about kind of drought methodologies, drought proofing your world as much as possible, adapting. And it's really good, and it's illustrated, has strong emphasis also for home gardeners and urban foresters. So I really recommend that, and I recommend that people find you on your website, which they can click on in this on our web. Any last shouts, or was that all? MLK Day. MLK Day, that was it.
Should volunteering have on a MLK. Nice send-off message prepared, but I guess it was real a pleasure, and we appreciate you all thinking of us for your show, and so we will keep you all posted and be in touch, and we really appreciate the opportunity to have a little time on your radio show.
Thank you so much, Severin.
Thank you guys for all you do. Thank you all to you listeners too, and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.